We apologize for the poor audio quality of this recording, but request you to listen as the content is very wise.
I'm not planning to give a very long discourse this afternoon. Our time is rather limited, and I'm thinking that the time that's spent by answering questions or discussing things that are of particular interest to members of the audience. But I will begin with saying a few words on the topic of resilience, but I think the first thing I should say is that this is not a term which is found within the Buddhist tradition as such. The way of talking about the mind in the Pali language looks at this quality of what we would call bounce back ability or resilience in a slightly different way. Nevertheless, I think it is a very useful way of talking about challenges that we face and qualities that we need to face them. And as I was walking through the school just now, I was reminded of a story from the martial arts tradition, in this case the Japanese martial arts Aikido. This is one of the most gentle of the martial arts, and one in which the master seeks to avoid conflict, if at all possible, and then to use the opponent's aggression against them rather than to act aggressively oneself. Anyway, balance and poise are very much stressed in this particular martial art. And in the anecdote, one of the students expresses his admiration for his teacher, saying, "Master, all the years I've trained with you, I've never seen you lose your balance, even once." And the teacher replied to him, "I lose my balance all the time, but I regain my balance so quickly you don't notice." And this idea of a master not necessarily being one who never loses his balance, but one who knows how to regain balance, I think is very applicable to this idea of resilience. And I think that many of you will probably, I hope, have observed from your own life, in your studies, or in sport, or in artistic endeavors, that we can often learn more from our defeats and our losses of balance than we do from our successes. And in Buddhism, we have a very positive view of human life. I think of all the major spiritual traditions, probably, which would be a surprise maybe for those of you who maybe led to believe Buddhism is a pessimistic tradition or religion, the core belief or conviction in Buddhism is in the human capacity for change, the human capacity for transformation. And the Buddha said that we really become fully human. We achieve our full potential as human beings through education or through training. the Buddhist teachings, which you may have come across, summarized as the Eightfold Path, is often telescoped or abbreviated as three kinds of training or education. So training and education are more or less synonymous in the language that the Buddha used. And these three kinds of kinds of training or areas of training or education are of our conduct, of our emotions, and of our thinking. And so the Buddha encouraged us to put faith in our capacity to train, our capacity to educate ourselves, or to put it differently, our capacity to learn from experience. So we heard that phrase, lifetime learning, and that is probably one of the most succinct representations of the Buddhist teachings. It is, in essence, a system of lifetime learning. The Arahant, the fully enlightened person, is referred to as the Asaka Pugala in the Buddhist language, which would translate into English as the graduate, the one who has finished his work, finished his education. And so the idea, the implication, of course, is that apart from Arahants, we are all in need of education, and we all become fully human through that effort that we put into our lives, and to learn from our experience. So, instinctually, we all enjoy pleasure, and we all dislike pain and suffering, and for most of us, in one form or another, up to one degree of sophistication or another, our life is a search to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. What is observed, what is noticeable, I would say, is that how bad we are at it, and how poor a job people make of what should be surely the number one project in a person's life. So the effort to train and to learn and to educate our conduct, educate our emotions, educate our thinking and our view of life is one in which we believe in our capacity to do that, and we take pride in that. And we believe that we can overcome difficulties. So, in order to be resilient, we have to have a basic conviction that we can be resilient. We have the capacity to be resilient. We have the capacity to overcome difficulties and obstacles that arise in our life, that the tools that we need are available. So Buddhism is not a belief system in the way that the great monotheistic religions are, but there are certain core beliefs, but they are essentially in the human capacity for training, for education, for change, and the necessity for that training. So to put it another way, when we look at our experience of pain and pleasure, happiness and suffering in life, we can see that there are many different causes and conditions that come into play. But if we are to prioritize them or to make a list and ask ourselves all the different things that make us happy, all the different things that influence our happiness, or influence the suffering we experience in life, what would be the number one? What would be the most important one? The Buddhist answer here is the mind. And we can ask ourselves or recall, I think, occasions in the past where everything's been going well, we're living in a beautiful place, we're living with these good people and everything that we can see and experience with the senses and measure are all really favorable. And yet, if we fall into a bad temper, we become jealous, become anxious, become depressed, then it's as if all those things become totally meaningless. Similarly, if we're in a rather unpleasant situation, unpleasant people around us, but for some reason or another, we feel good, we're in a good mood, we have some private cause of celebration, then that mental state takes precedence over the negative conditions that we can see around us. So this is a simple hypothesis or an observation that we can make, that various things affect our experience of happiness and pleasure in life. Some are more important than others, but the one that trumps all others, one that far exceeds the rest in its potency, is the mind. And so the Buddhist view is, that being the case, if we would like to avoid suffering and if we would like to experience more happiness in life, we have to turn attention to the mind. So please notice here, I'm not saying that it's all in the mind. You don't have to worry, just make your mind all right and everything else will be okay. The Buddha is not saying that, and indeed, the Buddha gave great importance to creating through laws and regulations and conventions and customs and agreements, conditions in families and in communities and in societies which promote human flourishing. And the word that the Buddha used to refer to Buddhism was the Dhamma Vinaya. So the Dhamma is like the teachings that lead to the truth of the way things are. And the Vinaya is all the ways that we create supporting conditions to aid us as far as possible in that practice of Dhamma. So the Buddha did give importance to external factors, but he gave most importance to the mind. And so, let's just say that we have four challenges, four important areas in which we need to put effort into our life. And these follow on from this initial hypothesis or suggestion that state of our mind, quality of our mind, integrity of our mind, the health of our mind, is absolutely central to a healthy and flourishing life. And the Buddhist analysis is that the conditions that underlie suffering in life are what we call defilements. That's to say, these are mental states that cause disturbance and distortion. They're like toxic elements in the mind. These include many different defilements into a group under the general heading of greed, a second group under the general heading of anger or hatred, and then a third group under the general heading of delusion. So as long as these defilements or negative mental states arise in our mind, we can never find any true security in life, any true happiness. So we, following from this suggestion, then there are two challenges. First is, how can we train our mind, how can we educate our mind in such a way as to prevent the arising of as yet unarisen mental defilements or negative mental states? Secondly, given that that's extremely difficult, in the case that our mind does become enveloped in anger or jealousy or anxiety or tension, stress, depression, how do we deal with that? How do we reduce? How do we let go? Or how do we eliminate negative mental states that have already arisen? Now, looking into the happiness of the mind, then similarly, having recognized its primacy in determining our general experience in life, the Buddha pointed to certain positive mental states or virtues as being the causal conditions for that happiness. And following from that, we have two more challenges. How can we introduce into our mind, how can we instill these positive mental states which as yet do not appear in our minds? And lastly, how can we stabilize, how can we nourish, how can we bring those positive mental states to maturity? So positive mental states here, I'm talking about such things as loving-kindness, compassion, mindfulness, inner clarity, stability, awareness, patient endurance, resilience, and so on and so forth. So I think what is key here is we're not just saying how we should be. You know, we shouldn't be a snowflake, we should be resilient, we should be this. I think we all know how we should not be, and we all know how we should be. The question is, how do we go from where we are right now to how we believe we should be? And this is a process which has to be approached with great consistency and patience and intelligence. And the Buddha is encouraging us to look at our experience very closely. And to look at your experience very closely, you have to develop the power of mindfulness. Because mindfulness is the ability to be present to your experience. We are usually not present to our experience, we are reacting to experience. And a very good example of this is physical pain. Now when we think, well, physical pain is a physical phenomenon, but maybe you may have thought, I certainly wondered about this, why we don't have, with all the sophisticated technology we have today, why don't we have a pain meter? Why can't a doctor say how many units of pain a patient is experiencing given a particular condition? Because pain levels vary from person to person. This is one indication that pain is not a merely physical phenomenon. And if we look closely into what happens when we feel pain, what we'll notice is there is an almost immediate mental reaction to the pain, which can be composed of fear, anxiety, anger, resentment, self-pity, etc. But this emotional reaction to pain happens so quickly that for the untrained eye, it just seems to be one thing, which we call pain. With the practice of mindfulness, we can separate these two. We can separate the purely physical phenomena from the mental reaction. One Buddhist teacher expressed this principle in an equation. He said, pain multiplied by resistance to pain equals suffering. So if you have a small physical pain, but you have a lot of resistance to it, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety around it, then multiplied together, you can have a lot of suffering. You might have a very lot of physical pain, but not so much mental resistance to it, and the same amount of suffering. If you have physical pain and zero mental reaction, it's multiplied by zero, and you can experience pain, but no suffering. So these are the kinds of propositions that the Buddha is putting in front of us. It's not a teaching encouraging us to believe, but saying, this is the proposition, this is the hypothesis, does this make sense? Look at your experience and see whether or not this is true. The more you grasp onto something as being me and mine, the more that you will suffer from it. The less that you can relate to experience, your physical experience, your emotional experience, your intellectual experience in terms of me and mine, the less suffering you will experience. So, resilience. How does resilience come to be? What are the enemies of resilience? What are the kinds of thoughts? What are the kinds of belief that you have about yourself which prevents you from being resilient? What are the kinds of beliefs and observations that strengthen resilience? This is something to be examined. So we're going from a position of saying all the good qualities that we should have and saying these are causal phenomena. These are phenomena that arise through the cultivation of the necessary and appropriate conditions. If you cultivate those conditions, then the result will arise. If you don't cultivate the conditions, no matter how much you would like the result, you'll be disappointed. So one of the analogies that my teacher gave for this education of the whole being, or the whole person, as Rupis will call it, is this idea of continual effort, constant effort. And my teacher would often express this with an analogy. He said it's like people in the old days, in Stone Age or whatever, trying to make fire with some pieces of wood. So let's say somebody was rubbing these pieces of wood together and they're doing more and they get tired and they get fed up and they put it down, let's have a rest for a while and then get back to it a bit later on. Come back to it a bit later on and start again. And then every time they get fed up or bored or distracted, then they put the two sticks together. And then finally they conclude that, this idea that you can rub two sticks together and make fire, it's fake news. I tried it myself. It doesn't work. I'm speaking from my own experience. Of course, the idea being here that there are certain kinds of effort, certain kinds of work that you can pick up and put down a bit later on. And there are other kinds of work which you can't do that. And spiritual effort is of the second kind. You have to create this kind of momentum, and you have to keep working at it. And you create an inner strength. And from that inner strength, stability of mind, in which there is a balance between effort and relaxation, then in which there is calm, but there is clarity within that calm. It's not just a fuzzy kind of walking up on another planet kind of calm. It's really extremely clear and bright. It's like super HD kind of awareness. This is the kind of tool, this is the mind that you develop, which enables you to weather through disappointments. And you see, and the I'm going to talk for very long, so I better end in a couple of minutes. But one one last thing to share with you is the teaching that my teacher gave to us, and he said, just this one thing, this is just keep this in mind. And it's a Thai word, mayne, which means not sure, or maybe it means maybe, maybe not. It means, so the idea is that whenever we have some strong thought, belief, emotion, what tends to happen is that we identify with that very much and consider it to be very real and very true, and subconsciously, at least, we ascribe a certain permanence to it. So the idea is that when we get excited, then it's all right, we just recognize, I'm excited, and it's not sure. I feel bored. Well, that's not sure. It's not a fixed thing. I'm happy. It's not sure. I'm not happy. It's unsure. I'm motivated. It's not sure. I'm unmotivated. It's not sure. I love. It's unsure. I hate. It's unsure. So what you're doing is this very radical undermining the reality of temporary mental states. You're not falsely giving them a solidity and a reality which they lack. You're saying, yes, that's what it is right now. It's no more than this, it's no less than this, this is what it is right now. And then we're moving away from reacting to experience out of instinct and habit and coming alive and responding with mindfulness and awareness. So one of the key principles here is, without mindfulness, we have very few choices. With mindfulness, we have many choices. So if we want to have more choices in life, more freedom in life, we have to expand this tiny window of opportunity. And this occurs when something arises of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, there's an impulse to consciousness. If we lack awareness, then we just go with that. We either grasp onto it or we push it away. But with mindfulness, we're there, we hold it, and we say, what is this? Is this appropriate, inappropriate, helpful, unhelpful? Will it lead to flourishing? Will it lead to pain and suffering? So our ability to make wise choices and to live our life in harmony with our principles is based upon the extent to which we can be present to experience, and that is dependent itself on mindfulness. And mindfulness doesn't just arise by itself. You can't get mindfulness through performing a ceremony or through prayer or through. It comes through training, and it's this training that daily and regular interest in your life, curiosity about your life, and learning from experience. So whether or not it's pleasant experience or unpleasant experience, it's all grist for the mill. It's all, it can all either be a cause of darkness and delusion, or it can be a cause of wisdom. And that's where you have some, you can really make your life, you can mold your life, you can take responsibility for your life once you have this power of awareness and clarity in your experience. So these are a few words I would like to share with you this afternoon. Maybe not all about resilience, but anyway, hopefully of some benefit to you.
Thank you very much indeed, Jayasaro. Some very wonderful insights and helpful insights. Now, as I said at the beginning, there's the opportunity to ask some questions. So you have pieces of paper. If you prefer to write questions on pieces of paper, can I suggest you think about questions now if you haven't already written some down? And then maybe you can pass the pieces of paper through to the center, this center over here. Pass the pieces of paper through to the center. Maybe Mr. Sprayer and Mr. Dawson could go down the center and collect some questions that you may have. So if you have a question and you're on this side, pass it down the line to the middle and similarly on this side. In the meantime, does anybody have any questions that they would like to ask in person? Anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask in person while we're collecting the written questions?
Please, sir, you can ask about anything you like. That doesn't have to be about the talk.
Well, I have a question here then, while we're waiting. Ajahn, did you try to find the way of life you were seeking in England while you were there, and how did that go?
It's such a long time ago. It's like a different lifetime. When I was a teenager, I had a couple of questions that seemed to me very important that wasn't really being addressed in my education. First was, what is the best way to live your life as a human being? And from that, there were sort of more questions sprang from that one. And obviously, well, is that even a reasonable question to ask? Is it possible to say this life is better than that life in the way that you could say this car is better than that car, or this phone is better than that phone? You know, to make distinctions and value judgments, you have to have certain criteria. And what are the criteria for deciding that one life is superior to another life? Is it a fool's question, and one that shouldn't be asked in the first place? So this was one question. The second question was, why is the world like this? Why is there so much pain, so much suffering, so much cruelty, so much injustice? Why is it like this? And does it have to be like this? If it has to be like this, if it's part of some kind of cosmic plan, then, well, you just have to put up with it. But does it have to be this way? And if it doesn't have to be this way, how could it be better? And if it could be better, what is your responsibility as an individual human being to be a part of that change, to try and make the world better if you believe that it can be better? So these questions absolutely consumed me to the point that I'm not a good example here. I didn't really keep up with my school studies very much, but I was reading until late at night and studying these topics on my own time, and school time, I guess, as well. So it was when I came across the teachings of the Buddha that I found that, for me at least, the teachings of the Buddha answered these questions and really gave me a sense of purpose and direction in my life. Right, do we have a question from the floor?
What was the hardest possession you had to let go?
Well, you know, when I was being introduced to the said that I gave up my worldly possessions to become a monk. Actually, I think my standard of living rose when I became a monk, because prior to that, I'd been living a very simple life, and I hardly had any possessions to give up, to tell you the truth. I don't think I had anything, really. I didn't, you know, those days there were no computers and iPads and phones, and I didn't have any money. So it wasn't a big deal for me leaving the world. And when I'd been in India and hitchhiking around the world, you know, I used to very strict budget, living on like $1 a day, and so that would cover everything, you know, like food and travel and everything.
So I lived extremely, say, ascetic life before I became a monk. And in some ways, having a hut in the forest and having a big meal in the morning was something of an upgrade for me.
Thank you. We have many, many questions here, so thank you all very much indeed. Here's a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy question. What is the meaning of life?
Oh, I can't remember. It's 800 and something.
I think it was 42 in the book. But, maybe there's another answer. Is there another answer?
Oh, another answer. Okay. I don't think it's a good question. One of the best things I was ever taught at school, because I was always asking questions, and a teacher put a comment in the margin of an essay I wrote. It says, don't think that every question has an answer. And I realized that I just always assumed, yeah, all questions must have answers. And then why? And so I don't think that that question, what is the meaning of life, is actually a question that has an intelligent answer. It's not a well-framed question. What I do think is a good question to ask is, what gives meaning to life? And it's not this thing called life that has something separate to it that you can extract from and say, well, this thing called life has this meaning. But what we can say is, what is it? What way of life? How can we live our lives in a way that we give meaning to life? And so there's no kind of fixed thing called life, it's what you make it.
Thank you very much. We have a topical question here. What do you think about the coronavirus? And what is your advice regarding the coronavirus? Did you say any questions?
Yeah, I'm probably not an authority on the coronavirus. I know I don't have it, so I just had something stuck up my nose the other day. So, yes, I'm not an authority figure on the coronavirus. Of all the different suggestions why it has occurred and why it's just probably the first of probably more in the future, I do feel that the analysis that makes sense to me is that through the destruction of the natural world, we're living in close proximity to many animals and living creatures which formerly we kept a safe distance from, and we lack the immune response to protect ourselves from them. So the sort of long-term, big picture response is being more careful about human resources and restricting the destruction of the natural environment, replanting trees, keeping safe distance from the wild animals. In the meantime, yes, it's a terrible thing. I mean, it's hard to talk about this kind of phenomena without falling into clichés. One observation or one thing I thought about is, I think that in every society, you have to find a balance between the needs, the welfare of the individual and the group, or the society at large. And so all the different societies in the world, this is like a spectrum. So like at one end of the spectrum, you have North Korea, let's say, where the common, the society takes almost complete precedent over the individual. Whereas in America, it's the exact opposite extreme, where the individual has taken such precedence now that a number of academics are saying they're not even sure whether there's even a concept of common good in America anymore. And so other countries are various, and Thailand, we're on the side spectrum towards the group taking precedence over the individual. But I think in Thailand they have quite a good balance, actually. And so in coronavirus, when you have something which is a threat to a whole country or a whole world, you can see that the countries which are, putting too much emphasis on the individual find it very difficult to respond well to this kind of threat. Whereas Thailand has been remarkably successful. Maybe there are many different causes and conditions for that. But I think that the sense of a common good and all pulling together in times of danger, and this is a strength of Thai society that I think, speaking as someone now Thai citizen, I feel very proud of. So keeping all the rules about washing hands and social distancing and wearing masks are appropriate, following the science would be my suggestion.
Thank you. If you could give the pupils of Rugby School Thailand one piece of advice, what would that be?
One piece of advice would be, don't look for simple answers. Every problem, every difficulty needs more than one particular piece of advice to deal with.
Did you ever regret becoming a monk?
Never. Not once. I feel incredibly blessed to be able to live this life.
How do you keep calm and not get mad?
Getting mad is based upon an ignorance of the situation. It's based upon poor thinking, unintelligent response to phenomena. So the more clearly you see things, the more you understand how things work, the less you will react in angry ways. In terms of the threefold education or training, which I referred to earlier on, this means any problem has to be dealt with in these three areas simultaneously. We call that holistic approach. So in terms of conduct, then the tool that you need to use is restraint. So you do not speak or act through anger or with anger, because whenever you do that, you feed the anger. You don't let it go through expressing it, you actually feed it. And it becomes a habit. So you need to restrain your expressions of anger. But that's not repressing it, you're aware that you're angry. In the emotional realm, you need to be cultivating the positive emotions that directly counter or prevent the arising of anger. And these include mindfulness, loving-kindness, compassion, and patience. But the most important element is that of wisdom and intelligence. So, why do we get angry? It's usually frustrated desire. We think, it should be like this. Why isn't it the way that we want it to be? He shouldn't say that to me. He shouldn't do that. She shouldn't be that way. She should be some. There's this idea of things shouldn't be the way they are. Why can't I get what I want to get? So these are all particular immature habits of mind that we've developed. But they're not who we are. They're just habits. And when we recognize them, and they think of, well, why does she say that? Why? Well, because of all the causes and conditions that lead that person to say that. Their background, their personality, their family situation, their current experience of pleasure and pain, their ideas, their beliefs. Any simple phenomena is conditioned by so many different factors. And so in the short answer, is looking at things in terms of causality, rather than he, she, me. And we look, what are the contributory factors? So whenever something goes wrong, and it comes in, who's to blame here? So that's always like an unwise way of looking at problems. You know, they'll say, well, now you're blaming the victim. Common criticism these days, talking about when bad things happen to people. But in Buddhism, we're not talking about who's to blame. We're saying, what has contributed towards this situation? So there'll be a contribution from that person, and there'll be a contribution from you, and there'll be a contribution from the environment. And the more you can see things in terms of contributions, rather than me and him and she and what should be and what shouldn't be, then the more calm you will become.
Thank you. What is the hardest thing about being a monk?
I don't want to sound like I'm boasting, but it's not so hard. Not for me, no. Let me tell you about when I first became a monk and what life is like in the forest monastery. So, living in the forest when I first came, there was no electricity, no running water. So we don't have any of those kinds of monk columns. The bell, morning bell in the monastery, goes at 3 a.m. and everyone has to be in the hall by 3:30. And there is chanting for half an hour, and meditation for an hour, and 5 o'clock tuning period. And 5:30, the monks walk into the surrounding villages on arms round. It can be 4 kilometers, 5 kilometers, 6 kilometers, even more. And come back, and then at 8 a.m., we have our one meal of the day. And following that, there is a cleaning period. And then during the middle of the day, the monks will go back to their huts and be practicing meditation or studying. And 3 p.m., there's a work period. And then 5 p.m., a cup of tea or some fruit juice. And then evening, 7 o'clock, chanting, and then meditation. And then some Dhamma talk until 9 or 10 p.m., and then, if you're not too tired, then meditate a bit more. So every day is from 3 a.m. till 10 p.m. On one meal a day, and so it's quite physically difficult. So I had just such great confidence and faith in what I was doing that I didn't find it subjectively oppressive because it's what I wanted to do. But physically, it's quite a challenge when you first begin.
Thank you. What is true happiness?
Well, I'm going to tell a story about Michelangelo. Michelangelo sculpted this incredible horse, and it's so lifelike. And someone asked him, how did you sculpt this incredible horse out of a block of stone? And Michelangelo said, well, I just chipped away all the bits that weren't the horse. So in real happiness, and if you can't really explain this, you can't put it into words, but I would say recognize and let go of all the counterfeit kinds of happiness, all the things that obstruct your experience of happiness, and you will find yourself.
Do you support the LGBTQ community and women's rights?
I don't have too much direct experience of this community, but I am definitely in favor of respect and kindness to all living beings, whatever their sexual orientation might be.
What is reincarnation?
We don't actually use the word reincarnation. We use the word rebirth. Let me try and explain this. First idea, Buddhism sees everything in terms of processes. So an analogy for this is with language. In language, we have nouns and verbs. Okay? So In Buddhism, there are no nouns. Every noun is a verb. There are only verbs. Everything you think is a noun is actually a verb. So life is a verb. Body is a verb. Feelings are a verb. Okay? So everything are verbs. So there's a stream of verbs. Now, one of the classic explanations of rebirth is if you imagine a candle and you light a candle. Now, many of you are scientists, I know, so maybe you could think, what exactly is a candle flame? Does anybody want to give an answer? What is a candle flame? It's not actually a thing, it's a process. It's an ongoing chemical reaction or oxidation. So as the flame burns on, the candle burns down. And let's say you were to light a second candle from the first candle. Now it's not like the first candle has been reborn, or it's not like the flame has been reborn. That's just a way of talking about it. But what it is an ongoing process in which the material basis of that process has changed significantly. But that's the end of it.
How do we fight against racism?
We don't want to fight against it. Don't participate in it. I think there is one thing. I think it's actually human nature, I would say, that we feel an instinctive pull towards people who look the same as we do. That's nothing to do with racism or prejudice. It's just something like an animal kind of instinct that you will find people who look like you safer or just instinctively. So I think sometimes people who are against racism can take it a bit too far and even feel themselves guilty for this kind of instinctual reaction to people who look differently from them. But that's hardly, to me, that's not significant. Significant is how you relate to the people around you, whoever they are, so say whatever sexual identity they have, what gender they are, what color they are. I mean, for me, the fact that people should be prejudiced on the basis of skin color is just so pathetic, really, isn't it? I mean, you see that all the thousands of years of human development and the technology and the creativity and the achievements of the human race, it's just, you pull that there, and then the fact that people will look at another person because of their skin color and feel prejudice or act unkindly towards them, it's shocking and I just feel pathetic. I just find it hard to understand. And it has to be said that, you know, by far, far away, the biggest culprits are white-skinned people, or they're called white-skinned people, not just white, really. And it's been a major blemish and assault of the Western cultures throughout history, and this definitely needs to be addressed and to be eliminated where possible. So it's obvious this is not, it's neither wise or kind or compassionate. It's foolish and destructive and harmful, and we need to do our best to at least in a multinational community especially never to allow those kinds of prejudice from having any kind of hold on our minds or on the way that we behave towards each other.
Thank you. time is much longer. I can see a question at the back there. You can find a microphone. Mr. Dawson. While we're waiting for the microphone to get there, one more question perhaps from me. Time is, as I say, pressing. What is your favourite part of being a Buddhist monk?
Yeah, I've not been sort of thinking about this as my favourite or the hardest or the easiest. I like meditating. I like meditating. I like answering questions, respectfully. I like answering questions that I have no idea what they're going to be beforehand. So.
Hello. I have a question. What is self-clarity truly, and how can one be a step closer to achieving it? Thank you.
Sorry to interrupt. What is self-clarity, I think, is the question. How can one be closer to achieving it?
Well, clarity of mind is one of the positive mental factors that we cultivate throughout our life as Buddhists. And we divide mental cultivation into like formal cultivation and informal cultivation. The formal cultivation would be sitting and walking meditation. So in meditation practice, we choose an object, for instance, the sensation of the breath at the nostrils, the anchor for awareness. And then the goal is to create an alertness and clarity, sharpness of mind, which is at the same time relaxed and warm and gentle with that meditation object. And so it's very difficult to do that, and we tend to either stray into too much effort and not enough relaxation and get stressed, or else too much relaxation and not enough effort and drift off into daydreams or get sleepy. But through continual patient effort, then the ability to be clear and sharp and aware and alert and awake in the present moment, whatever the content of experience, becomes stronger and stronger. So it's like any skill, it's like playing the piano or whatever. It's something that it's not mystic, it's not beyond human capabilities, but it is really challenging and difficult, and it needs a great deal of application and patience in order to achieve it. But nevertheless, without achieving great results, if you just put some effort and you see some positive change taking place as a result of your efforts, then that is a good sign, and it's something which will give you the inspiration to carry on and to develop that further.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We have one more question I can see from the floor over there. I've got lots more questions in front of me. I'm sorry I haven't been able to ask them all. As I say, time is beating us. Is anybody who feels frustrated that their question has not been asked and would like to ask it?
We do have one here.
Yeah, Mr. Dawson, thank you.
What does Buddhism say about whether or not equality can be achieved?
What do you mean by equality?
Well, you said in your speech that you had questions about whether there has to be so much suffering, and you said Buddhism answered those questions.
Yeah.
So what does it say about that?
Yeah, I'd like to know what you mean by equality. I'm not quite clear what you mean by that.
Like improvement over the state things are now.
Well, sure, yeah, I'm in favor of improvement. But is that what equality, what exactly is being equal? What does that mean?
A utopia?
No, let's say if you could do one thing to make this school more equal, what would you do?
I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of quite a difficult concept, isn't it, equality? It's something really worth thinking about because, you know, we're all different. You know, so, you know, we can't all be the same. So if equality means all being the same, well, that's not really achievable. But do we mean like equality of opportunity? Or do we mean everyone has similar amounts of power? Or, you know, in what particular areas would we like to be equal? Or why do we think that being equal would necessarily provide improvement?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm interested in your answer, but I'm not sure we have enough time to make it anything more than a rhetorical question. I mean, yeah, I'll leave it with you to think through.
Okay.
All right. Any other final questions? Sorry, signal this, time is beating us. Oh, you have a question. Sorry, Kuntoya's question. I thought he was going to say a few words. Kuntoya's question.
I think everyone felt this, you know, one time or another. It's about giving up. I mean, you could have family matter, family situation, or your school, at school, if you were giving up and up, you were failing, you want to give up. Or even that, you know, when you are happy, you can give up as well. Then you have everything. You think that's just enough. Is there any way of, you know, trying to come out of that? Even if life is still going on.
Giving up in the long hair?
Yes. Why should I keep doing this? Why should I keep, you know, fighting?
This is maybe just tangential to what you're asking. I'd like to share this with you anyway. And it's a very useful analogy. You see, we have a goal. And that goal is like an island in the middle of a lake. And we're swimming towards that goal. So there's a wise approach and an unwise approach. The unwise approach is the swimmer is constantly lifting their head up and saying, how much further, how much further? And of course you know, the more you do that, then the slower you seem to go. But it's not just that it seems that way, but it's actually that way, because if you're lifting your head up, then your stroke, you're not making a good swimming stroke. So this is unwise, and that subjectively, it just feels like we're never getting anywhere. You feel very frustrated. But also you're acting against your best interest because that very interest in the goal far ahead is it's preventing you from creating the causes and conditions for realizing it. So the wise swimmer looks up every now and again just to check whether or not the island is still straight ahead. But most of the effort, most of the intelligence is put into making the best possible stroke that we can make. So the analogy here is that why I'm answering your question this way is I think that a lot of the frustration and sense of taut hair and so losing kind of inspiration or wanting to give up is because we're too concerned with the goal ahead and how far away we are from it and why is it taking so long. But if you can find joy and interest in the creating the causes and through putting forth the effort itself, enjoying the work itself for its own sake, taking pride in what you do, it's not that you'll be any less successful. You still get it, you may get there faster indeed. But, you know, if we put all our hopes for happiness in the future, in gaining some prize, in making money, being famous, getting this or realizing your dream, and then you're overlooking the quality of your life in the meantime, because most of our life is spent in the meantime. You know, so it makes more sense, how can we bring quality to our lives and happiness as we're walking the path, and not until we get what we want to get. Because to be frank, often when you get what you want to get, it's not what it was cracked up to be. And then you have to find something else. So it makes sense to, how can I make today as good as it possibly can be? You know, rather than saying that today is just another day I get through it, so I can get what I want to get at the end of it.
Alright, well, thank you very much, Jayasaro, for an absolutely fascinating talk. I have to say, as a mentor of Athens, Rang has been Thailand for 5 years, I've been very curious about Buddhism, and the opportunity to have explained so wisely and in such an intelligent way by somebody from the UK is something that I guess I didn't expect to have whilst I was here. It's been very, very interesting, I'm sure, to everybody here. We're very, very grateful to you. Thank you very much for coming along today. I'd now like to invite our CEO, Khun Thoy, to make a presentation. And thank you very much. And if any parents wish to come up to make a presentation, then this is the opportunity to do so as well. In the meantime, my thanks on behalf of everybody here to Ajahn Jayasaro for an absolutely wonderful talk.
So maybe we just have like a traditional Buddhist ending to the meeting, and I'll give a short lesson.
Yatha varivaha pura paripurenti sagaram eva meva ito hinnam petanam upakapati ichitam varitam uthan kippa meva samichato sakhe purentu sandhupa Chanto annaraso yatha manicho giraso yatha sabhitiyo ima chanto Sattaroko innasato matemu akvandarayo sukhi tikhayutho bhava Abhivadrasilisa nityam utha pachayino Chattaro dhamma vatantiyayumano sukham Hello.